So if you were here yesterday or the day before, there's still just this. And if you weren't here yesterday or the day before, there's just this. There's just this. There's just whatever is arising. Whatever phenomena are present. Sight, sound, touch, colour, perceptions of any kind, anything that arises can only arise in this. There's nothing else. There's nothing in which anything else can arise. If it's a thought about an apparent past, it arises in this. If it's a thought about an apparent future, it arises in this. If it's a feeling about something that apparently happened yesterday, it arises in this. In a way, what I'm saying is stunningly obvious. In a way it is. It's stunningly obvious that all there is this. There isn't last night. There isn't a minute ago. There isn't a second ago. And isn't that obvious? Isn't that completely and utterly obvious? And yet, and yet, and yet, and yet, and yet, something in us resists that enormously. The number of arguments and probably fights that have started over this simple statement. What do you mean there's just this? Of course there's not just this. But there is. And it's kind of obvious, and it's kind of highly confrontative, because it confronts everything that we believe ourselves to be. It doesn't confront what we are, but it confronts everything that we believe ourselves to be. Of course, notice that any belief we have about what we are can also only arise in this. So the belief may be, or perhaps usually is, something around, I won't try to tie it down too tightly, but something around, I am a separate person. I exist in time. I swim, as it were, in this stuff called time, rather like a fish swims in that stuff called water. But because I am a separate person, I live in a separate world. I'm in here, and there's a separate world out there in which I move. So there's not just time, there's also space. So I am like a fish swimming in two different kinds of water. I swim through time, and I swim through space. And I have a, because I live in time, I have a past, I have a future, I have a beginning, and I have at least a physical end. You know, I have a physical beginning called birth, and memories of childhood, and I have a physical end called death. And maybe I have a different metaphysical birth and a different metaphysical future. Perhaps these thoughts may arise in this. I may have a story that says I have many, many different metaphysical existences. Perhaps I've adopted the story of many lives, of birth and rebirth and endless rebirth. Who knows? I might live in that kind of water. The water I live in might have that particular flavour. I might live in Buddhist water, for example. Or I might live in Judeo-Christian water, in which I have a metaphysical existence of a different kind after death. Or perhaps I live in a secular scientific water, but still there's time in which I live, bounded by birth and death, and a trajectory in between the two. And probably I will add to that some sort of story about meaning and purpose, that this has a meaning, and this has a meaning, and this has a purpose, and this has a purpose. And I move, this moves through that in order to fulfill its purpose, or perhaps to not fulfill its purpose. And all sorts of feelings will arise around this whole. I'm spinning a great big story now that says this isn't all there is, that this isn't it, that it is it. But we live in a story that says that it isn't it. And that story, it's probably quite obvious by now, may give rise to all sorts of delicious feelings that go with it. Feelings that really can only have to do with a sense of time and a sense of past and future. I mean, that lovely, tasty, beautiful, delicious feeling called regret, for example. I mean, regret can clearly only belong in a story of time, because regret is about something called the past. And that wonderful, delicious, juicy, crunchy story called hope, which of course can only live in the story of time, because it's about the future. There are more existential feelings that perhaps we could say belong just to this. We've talked to some extent already over this weekend about despair. Well, perhaps despair is a bit more this than regret and hope are. So all of this stuff is carried by the person, or we might say by the one who believes himself to be a person, or we might say by oneness arising as the sense that there is a separate person, because that's really, we could say, well, there's nothing going on, but if there were anything going on, that would be what's going on. There's nothing going on. This is nothing going on. But if there were something going on, it would be oneness thinking that it's a separate person living in time, with purpose and meaning and story. Even if the story might be an existential story. The existential story is, there is no story, now I've got to find my own story. That's kind of summing up 100 years of existentialism in a sentence. There is no story, so it's up to me to find my own story. That's still a statement of separation. It's still a statement that only the one who feels himself to be a person can make. I've been reading some books recently about cognitive biases, which are kind of traps in the mind. They're ways of thinking, they're ways of perceiving, which are inescapable. You know, we can't avoid them, and yet they're erroneous. And you could say that the greatest cognitive bias of all is the cognitive bias that has us believing that we are separate, that we are a separate self with all of the things that that carries. a couple of other things I'll throw in that I haven't mentioned yet to add to past and future and story and feelings of guilt and regret and hope, a sense of responsibility, a sense of free will, a sense that we are able to make choices, a sense that a great deal may depend on the choices that we make. These are some of the other things that go along with that enormous cognitive bias. That sense that I am a separate person. I'm a separate person with a past, a future, responsibility, choice. Di-da, 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 on and on and on it goes.
That body is existing.
Yeah, apparently. And so?
I'm confused.
The body exists, apparently. Absolutely. Yeah. The glass of water exists, apparently. Yeah. Are they separate? Do they exist separately?
Mm.
No. Even on a basic physical level, we know that there isn't separation of that kind, thanks to particle physics, which I am not going to talk about much because I know nothing about it. Yeah. The physical body exists, apparently. Yeah, so let's make a slight detour there from what I was saying into the world of the nighttime dream, which I've already referred to, or yesterday, as we were talking about, into the world of the movies, of the cinema. In the nighttime dream, yeah, a physical body apparently exists. It goes to Berlin Hauptbahnhof in the nighttime dream, which apparently exists. It gets on a train to Frankfurt, and the train apparently exists. An apparent us sits on an apparent seat on an apparent train, and the door opens and a ticket inspector comes in and says, I want to see your ticket. And maybe because it's a nighttime dream and not a daytime dream, the ticket inspector may be a cow. The door may open and a ticket inspector comes in and it's a cow in a ticket inspector's uniform, and because it's a dream, it seems entirely and totally and absolutely natural. We don't you have no surprise at all. I bet in the daytime dream you'd be very surprised if came into it. But because it's a nighttime dream, this is completely accepted and no surprise whatsoever. You see, we could say there's another cognitive illusion going on in the nighttime dream. The cognitive illusion is it's perfectly normal in a nighttime dream for a cow to get a job as a ticket inspector on the German railway system. Why not? You know, and the journey goes on and we get out, and I can't remember where the train was going at the beginning, but because this is a dream, it doesn't get there. We get out in Paris. Except that Paris is covered in water like Venice, and all of this is physically real, apparently. And the moment the one who's having the dream wakes up in the morning, it's known that none of that was real. All of it was real, and none of it was real. So it's a metaphor, it's only a metaphor, but it's an extremely good metaphor for what we're talking about here. As a very good Dutch author who wrote about this called Leo Hartman. And he really nails the point at which the metaphor I'm using breaks down. So we need to be really clear about it. The one in the nighttime dream, they wake up from the dream. And it's immediately obvious that although all of that happened, none of it happened. It both happened and it didn't happen. We can't say, well, none of it was real. It was a real dream. It was certainly different to dreamless sleep. It was a real dream. It really happened. All of that really happened in the nighttime dream. The experience of that was totally different from the experience of dreamless sleep. So it was completely real within the dream. And then we wake up in the morning and we know, we wake up from the dream in the morning and we know that it was completely unreal. It's not one or the other, it's both. It was completely real to the one in the dream, to the character in the dream. And then when we wake up from the dream, it's seen that it's also completely unreal. And these two statements do not contradict each other. And this is where the mind begins to break down. Because the mind says, well, if you say it's completely real, and then you come along with another statement, it's completely unreal, the second statement must contradict the first statement. No, it doesn't. For the character in the dream, it's completely real. When you wake up from the dream in the morning, it's completely unreal. Both of those things are true. Now, as Leo Hartung points out, this is a good metaphor for what we're talking about here. We're talking about waking up here. We're talking about waking up from the dream of being a person. But as Leo Hartung points out, there is a significant difference, which is that unless waking up to this dream, unless it is coincident with physical death, then we're not talking about waking up from this dream, we're talking about, in Leo's phrase, we're talking about waking up to the dream. He's written a very good book and it has that title, Waking Up to the Dream. Now if we really spin that out, what he means is, in awakening, in liberation, as we're talking about it here, we wake up to the reality that this is a dream. So that's the difference between waking up from, when you wake up from the nighttime dream ends. On physical death, this daytime dream ends. So waking up from the nighttime dream, the exact equivalent of that in this dream is physical death, which I'm kind of assuming that none of us are here particularly craving. I'm just sort of assuming that, you know, that we're here for, you know, we want another cup of tea, we want another chocolate biscuit, we're not yet ready to willingly embrace physical death. So what we're talking about here is waking to the dream, waking up to the fact that this is a dream. It's a kind of dream. Does that make it unreal? No. It makes it a real dream. Yeah. Does it mean that it's unreal? No, not to the character who lives in the dream. The character who lives in the dream is there, and there, and there, and there, and here. Okay, unless there's physical death, the character who lives in the dream goes on living in the dream. Is it real? Yes, of course it is, because the level of reality of the waking dream is the same as the level of reality of the character in the waking dream. That's why on waking up in the sense that we're talking about it here, you do not find that you can miraculously walk through walls. Now if you have a particular philosophical and also perhaps argumentative frame of mind, you might say, well, you know, if there's a waking up to seeing that this is a dream, that this is in a sense unreal, then why not manifest the city, I suppose it would be called in yogic philosophy, why not manifest the city of walking through walls? In fact, the city of walking through walls is sometimes made a great deal of in yogic philosophy, just as is the city of levitation. Well, if it's seen that this is a dream, if that's absolutely seen, then why does the city of walking through walls not manifest? Because I bet it doesn't manifest. I don't care how many of us try and walk through that wall this afternoon. I mean, I'm willing to bet a great deal of money on the fact that the city of walking through walls will not manifest. Why is that? If that's a dream wall, why is that? Well, it's because that dream wall has the same level of reality as that dream person and that dream person and this dream person. So for the dream character, This is real. Of course it's real. For the dream character where awakening has happened, this is real. Of course it's real. And it's unreal. And it's unreal. If you like, you could say that's the difference. For the dream character who is asleep, and by the way, there is no difference between being asleep and being awake, and maybe we can talk about that a little later on. I don't want to put too much in at once. But for the dream character who is asleep, this is simply real. It's simply real. And they have the same level of reality. It's simply real. This real asks will not sink through this real chair because they have the same level of reality. To the one who is awakened, this is still real and it's unreal. It's both. Like the nighttime dream, it's not one or the other. To say it's real and then to say it's unreal is not a contradiction. It's both.
Could you say that waking up to the dream, in to the daytime dream, could you compare it to a nighttime dream that changes into a lucid dream?
Yes, in a way. I mean, there's a lot of arguments about lucid dreams, about whether such a thing even really exists and so forth, but in a way, setting that all aside, you could say that is a better metaphor, it's a better analogy. You could say that waking up in the sense that we're talking about here is like going from a normal nighttime dream state into a lucid nighttime dream state. Because it is said of a lucid dream state that the one who is dreaming becomes aware that they are dreaming, and yet the dream goes on. So, yeah, it's a very good analogy.
Yeah. Jack McKenna has been using this metaphor about sitting in a cinema, watching a film, and being totally lost in the character.
Yeah.
And then he said, awakening means you become aware that you sit in a chair and the character is just a character in the film.
Yes.
But that's only a step.
Yes. Well, I'm saying yes. I want to wait to see what happens next before I say yes. I withdraw that yes because I don't know what you're going to say there.
If you wake up, if I'm in the chair watching the film and being aware that you're not this film character, it's only one step. But the next step is just getting out of the cinema.
But what does he mean by that?
I mean, you are still within the dream, even though there seems to be a state even beyond lucid dreaming, even beyond waking up within the dream, but falling out of the dream altogether.
Well, I find my own metaphors confusing. I'm certainly not going to start commenting in any detail on somebody else's metaphor. I don't know what he means by that. I might say, well, you know, getting out of the cinema, that might be physical death. The fact is, you know, what we're talking about here, I have no idea if this is what he's getting at. It's not even a comment on what he's saying, let alone a criticism. I don't know whether to say almost impossible or impossible for the one who lives in separation to get hold of, is that what we're talking about here is not about an experience. So it's not about how the film is experienced. I mean, for example, I don't know if this will work, but pursuing that metaphor, you know, the one sitting in the cinema might be completely lost and absorbed in the film, right? Or they might be completely lost and absorbed in the popcorn that they're eating. You know, there are all sorts of different experiences of being in a cinema. Well, they might be, if they're sitting in the back row with their girlfriend, they might be completely lost and absorbed in what in England we call necking. Necking. Chewing each other's face off is a less attractive metaphor. You know, what I'm trying to say is the experience of being in a cinema is not a unitary experience. I could be anything, you know, I could be sitting in a cinema and unfortunately I put on these lovely new shoes that I bought today and I'm so proud of and I'm just becoming aware roundabout, you know, 20 minutes in, you know, just as Spaceman is about to tackle Spider-Woman, that actually this shoe is really too tight and it's giving me a... And so, you know, the experience of sitting in the cinema watching Spaceman fight with Spider-Woman is actually the experience of an overtight shoe, which interestingly is another quite good metaphor for what it's like to be a separate person. It's a bit like wearing an overtight shoe, in the sense that when the overtight shoe comes off, there can be a sort of, oh, a sort of expansion and relaxation. And when the sense of separation releases, there can be a sense of, oh, expansion and separation. You see, so there can be many, many, many different experiences from sitting in a cinema. The problem for the one who feels separate, it's kind of obvious that cinemas are full of experiences, but the problem for the one who feels separate, if they contemplate awakening and liberation, well, if they believe, they can't actually contemplate liberation or awakening, but if they believe they are contemplating awakening and liberation, it's almost inevitable. I'm putting the word almost in there just as a little insurance policy in case somebody catches me out with a difficult question. But it's almost inevitable that this can only be conceived of, what we're talking about, can only be conceived of in some way or other as an experience. An experience of some kind. It's kind of like, okay, what's being awake like? It's kind of like not being awake, but it's kind of more expansive and there's a bit more pink candy floss in the room. Maybe. You know, that might be the thinking. Who knows? But the one who feels themselves separate can only think in terms of them. It must be a change in experience. There's only two possibilities in a way for how that change in experience can be. It's got to be either a change in experience out there or a change in experience in here, because this is how the one who feels separate thinks. They think of an in here and an out there. So, for example, I mean, I'm painting a bit of a caricature out now, but just for the sake of the story I'm telling, you know, a change in experience, it could be, you know, seeing the psychedelic energies moving in the wall out there, or it could be a dropping away of resentment and anger in here and just feeling this lovely, lovey peacefulness in here. You know, one or the other. Or maybe, if I'm really lucky, both. So maybe I'll get, you know, nice warm candy floss feeling in here and I'll see the psychedelic energies moving in the wall out there. For the one who feels separate, it's impossible. Well, it is impossible to conceive of what we're talking about, but for the one who lives in separation, if they try to conceive of it, which they're quite likely to, it's always got to be as an experience. So in the cinema, it might be, oh, the experience of having nicer popcorn or a more exciting film on the screen, or seeing the film, or seeing the screen behind the story, if they've read some kind of philosophical stuff about this, maybe, oh, it must be about seeing the film behind the story, or whatever, whatever, whatever. The problem with all of this is that what we're talking about isn't an experience. It's not a change in experience. It's got nothing to do with what experience is actually taking place. It is seeing that out of which all experience arises. What's that like? It isn't like anything. I mean, that question, what's it like, can only be answered by reference to an experience. What's it like? It's like eating strawberry trifle. What's it like? It's like swimming in honey. What's it like? It's like listening to Mozart backwards. I don't know. You know, that question, what's it like, is a very natural question. It's an entirely natural question, but it can only be answered by reference to some experience or other. And the problem with what we're talking about is it isn't an experience. It's seeing that out of which all experience arises. What's that like? It's not like anything. We could equally say, what's that like? It's like everything. Because it is that out of which all experience arises. So the mind of the one who lives in separation almost certainly cannot help telling itself stories about this based on whatever concepts have been picked up from Buddhism or Hinduism or Christian mysticism or philosophy or listening to other people talk or whatever. It can't help telling itself stories. All of those stories are wrong. If told from the, when told from the position of the one who feels separate. So I was referring, I can't remember whether yesterday or the day before, I did an interview a few days ago, and one of the questions was about an end to suffering, which is very big in Buddhism, or is believed to be very big in Buddhism. We can argue about that. I won't go down that path, it's a bit too philosophical maybe. An end to suffering. Lovely thought. Oh, lovely thought. They say that L. Ron Hubbard was the first person to say, bring me a revolver and I'll liberate anybody. You want an end to suffering? Bring me a revolver. It's such a lovely idea. Oh, such a lovely idea. But this isn't about suffering. It's not about an end to suffering. It's not about a beginning to suffering. It's not about anything in particular. It's about seeing that out of which everything arises. Now, when this is seen, I don't want to hold out any promises here, but when this is seen, there may well be a different orientation to suffering. There may well be a difference in how the experience of suffering arises. You know, but the simple answer to the one who feels just this must hold out the promise of an end to suffering, well, there are two simple answers. One is bringing a revolver, but the other is the toothache is a toothache. Is a toothache. Is a toothache. Gertrude Stein, was supposed to have said a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose? Absolutely incontrovertibly true, and a toothache is a toothache is a toothache is a toothache. However you define it, a toothache is a toothache. A toothache experienced by no one is still a toothache. I mean, I don't usually give advice, but I give one piece of advice now, which I believe to be, you know, very sound advice. If you have a toothache, don't seek liberation, go to a dentist. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? Some of those who live in separation, we can get worn down by life. I mean, it's tough living in separation. It may be, it's not necessarily, but it can be kind of tough. And after 30, 40, 50, 60 years of that, well, it's hardly surprising that we might find very attractive a story that says there is some, you know, there's a possibility of just living in some constant state of bliss without the need for a revolver. Of course, it's a lovely, attractive, beautiful story. It's beautiful. It's also crap. Life is what life is. Life is what life is. If toothache arises, it arises. And what we're talking about here is whether life simply arises or whether it seems to arise for one who lives in separation, whether it the one who lives inside that life, as it were. I mean, this is just life happening. This is just life happening. This is just life happening. The question is whether what seems to be happening is life is happening for one who lives inside it and feels separate from it. That's all we're talking about here. If liberation has any meaning, which it doesn't really, but if liberation has any meaning, it's seeing that the one who thought that they were separate doesn't exist. We could say what appears to be the object, the one who believes they are separate, is actually just a process. It's a kind of thinking feeling of separation which goes on. I say thinking feeling because it isn't simply a thought and it isn't simply a feeling. You could say sense. It's not really even a sensation, it's a sense. So there seems to be an object, a person who feels himself to be separate. There isn't really a person who feels himself to be separate, but there may be the arising of an apparent process of the sensation or the sensing of separateness. And then, of course, everything about life, about this, becomes predicated on that. Including all the stuff that I started off by talking about, like the sense that I have a past, I have a future, maybe I have a purpose, maybe I have a meaning, I certainly have responsibilities and choices and free will and stuff like that. And all of that, all of it collapses. I mean, it's possible to deconstruct these things individually and separately, philosophically. But all of that just simply collapses. It all collapses at once when the sense of separation collapses.
I'm sticking to your three words. Homeless.
Yeah, the great mantra there.
I still somehow am busy with what you said, like there is no end of suffering.
I didn't say that. I said, bring me a revolver.
And even then, how can we be sure about it?
Oh, yes. So?
Yeah, like what Ramesh Vaisekar said, this, like, if there is seen that there is nobody, then there is no blame, no guilt, no pride, no shame. That sounds like at least a lot of less suffering, if not...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't say that, did I? I didn't say there may not be less suffering. But I mean, if what we're looking for is an end to suffering, it's the revolver we need. And as you say, then how do we know? Then how do we know? You know, we go off into metaphysics and all sorts of possible stories and so forth. Yeah, I didn't say that. Yeah, again, I feel like I've come here with the great mantra, hope this helps, is meaningless. I haven't come here to offer hope. But nevertheless, there. Yes, you're right. There. I mean, as I've said several times already, there are no necessary consequences in the seeing of liberation. But there are tendencies. There are tendencies, and for example, one of the tendencies I've already mentioned, I think yesterday, is there is certainly a tendency for neurosis to decrease, if not to disappear. Now, in a fairly obvious way, neurosis creates a lot of suffering. So if neurosis decreases, we might expect there to be less suffering. Nevertheless, the least neurotic body, mind, system in the world can still get toothache.
Yes.
So unless we're defining suffering in a very, very, to me, very peculiar way, Toothache is toothache.
And also there is something that keeps coming to my mind is like we can only experience things in contrast. And for example, if I enjoy a meal very much, I do enjoy so much because maybe I was very hungry before. And like, is like if there's never anything unpleasant, I cannot imagine that there could be anything pleasant. So, and I eat, it's only imagination, but I even cannot imagine that, like, if there seems that there's no self, and but this, the body's not dead, it will go on with pleasant and unpleasant, if, because otherwise it is death.
Like, dislike?
Hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. Why not? Yeah. If you don't like herrings now, as a separate person, it's unlikely that you'll like herrings if the person collapses. Why should that change?
I like to laugh because I had a bratwurst yesterday.
Because what?
I had a bratwurst yesterday after the talk. And
right.
It's really not what I'm eating usually.
Right. So, what's happened then?
I don't know, just some punch on the pear.
So it turns out that there's an exception to what I said. So, after liberation, there's no reasons why preferences should change except for bratwurst.
I don't know.
There's something about the seeing, I have already referred to this, it's a kind of unreal distinction in a way, but in another way it isn't, this distinction between awakening in which the emptiness of this is seen, and let's call it liberation in which the fullness of this is seen, and I've referred already, you know, what that fullness is about, this seeing unconditional love, it's seeing the nature of unconditional love, if you like. There is something about that which changes everything. It changes everything, therefore it's going to change the way suffering is experienced. If you want a kind of slightly more sort of psychological slant on this, and this isn't inevitable, but it's extremely common, there tends to be a reduction in neurosis. What neurosis does often is it tends to tone down the intensity of suffering but make it last for a much longer time.
Mm.
So it's quite likely that if this is seen for what it is in its fullness and the level of neurosis reduces, it's quite likely that suffering may be more intense but will be over much quicker. It's quite likely, it's not inevitable. But for example, you know, where the non-neurotic may experience a flash of anger, the neurotic person may experience a month of irritation or an hour of irritation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a tendency for that, we could say. There's a tendency. It's less likely that you'll be irritable for a month, more likely that you might have just a flash of anger and it's gone.
Yeah, if you take pain, so pain arises, but suffering is just only considering the pain as a problem, and this can fall away.
Yeah, if you like, yeah. I mean, we can give all sorts of definitions. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, toothache is still toothache, and if the toothache isn't taken to a dentist, then there's probably a continuing problem, but we can define it differently. Yeah, you could say that. Yeah. You could say that the story that the person makes out of whatever suffering is arising, whatever it might be, if it's arising, that that's a kind of an additional problem or an additional suffering. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not that there is a choice, but given the possibility of 5 minutes of anger or a month of irritation, I know which I prefer. there's something else about neurosis I'll mention as well. This is getting a bit psychological and a bit psychotherapeutic, but never mind. There's something else that happens with neurosis. I mean, neurosis is a kind of flypaper for stories. So where there's a kind of neurotic response, there tends to be a neurotic story in the head. And the problem with these neurotic stories in the head is they can just go on and on forever. You know, they are hamster wheels that we climb into. And we can just go on forever and they don't go anywhere and they don't allow the psychophysical system to heal itself or to clear itself because we're just going round and round the hamster wheel and then he said and then he said and do you know what he did next and this can just run forever. And again, if there's less neurosis, then there's less likely to be this story grinding on and on and on. Again, it's just more likely just to be the spontaneous arising of feeling and the spontaneous falling away of feeling as well.
There seems to be also a cultural impact in how awakening happens. I mean, the way you describe it or many Western teachers describe it sounds like a rather profane experience.
A rather what?
Profane experience. You basically go on with your life and if you look at all these crazy Indians who stop eating, need to get fat and don't talk anymore, can't even walk anymore. And it's quite a common phenomenon in India that many of these Indian babas or amas totally get lost and they're not able to live their life anymore. I mean, it's the same experience. So, there must be some cultural, or is it something completely different? Or do they go deeper into the experience? Or
it's not an experience.
How can it be less or more in oneness?
It's not an experience. There's no one who can go deeper into it, but it's not an experience. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities as to what's going on. One is there is an extremely strong tradition in India of, well, the fakir is one tradition, you know, the ascetic is another tradition. There's a very, very strong tradition for that. The culture kind of is set up to allow that in a way, much more than it is here. I mean, there are reports here, powerful awakenings where all that can happen after that for a year or two is the individual just sits on a park bench going, wow, for 2 years. And perhaps they're in a kind of practical situation where it's possible for that to happen. It's quite possible that that same individual, I'm just hypothesizing, if they were actually going to lose their house if they didn't go to work tomorrow and pay the mortgage, would actually get their arse up off the bench and would go to work the next day to pay the mortgage. Who knows, you know. It doesn't matter. I mean, none of this matters. But different cultures sort of have different traditions. I mean, in India, it's more likely that a few people might come along and go, wow, and look after you. Mm-hmm. Bring you your food and so forth. I'm tempted at this point to tell a very long anecdote that I know some of you in the room would have heard before, but anyway, we'll see. But I mean, it's much more likely, isn't it? I mean, to be honest, if you live in Birmingham, and I suspect the same in Berlin, and there's this amazing awakening, and they're just sitting on a park bench, after a time, it's probably quite likely you'll get quite hungry and quite cold, and nobody will come along and go, oh master, or oh mistress, oh master, you have seen something. You know, perhaps if I sit here with you and feed you and build a little ashram for you and give you money and feed you some more, perhaps I will be infected with it. Perhaps I will catch it from you like the influenza. But that's a very, very strong tradition in India. So maybe that's what's going on. You know the story. How many of you know the story of the guru's son who gets thrown out of his father's ashram? Well, I'll try to shorten it because this can go on for several hours, but I'll try to make sure the version. So there's a very famous guru. I mean, he's enormously famous, and he's got a huge ashram, and hundreds of people come, thousands of people come. He has one small problem in his life. He has a son who is a complete wastrel. His son is incompetent at everything. Any job they give the son messes up. They tell the son to take the holy ashram elephant out to the water pool and wash him down, and the son loses him in the jungle. Or, you know, everything that the son does is just a disaster. Eventually the father gets completely fed up and he throws him out of the ashram. He says, "Be gone, I don't want any more to do with you." So the guru's son sets off feeling very disconsolate and unhappy. All he's got is his rather old, rather sick donkey and a few clothes done up in a bundle, and he's walking off, and he walks for a few days, getting further and further and further away from the ashram. And then to add to his misery, he's walking along one morning and the donkey suddenly turns up its legs and dies. It just sort of lays down in the road and dies. And the guru's son is so, you know, this is the last straw, and he's so distraught at this, he just sits down at the side of the road by the dead donkey, and he just sort of sits there like this with his head down. He kind of gives up. But after a while, some travellers come along and they see the guru's son and the dead donkey and say, "Look at this poor man. His donkey has died, and this man, he must have loved this donkey so much. He's so upset he hasn't even got the strength to bury the donkey. Let's bury the donkey for him." So they kind of dig a pit and they put the donkey in it, and then they pile up the earth over the donkey and the mound, and they go on. After a while, some more travellers come along and they say, "Look at this poor man. He's sitting by a burial mound and he looks so sad. You know, somebody very important to him must have died. Maybe it's his father, maybe it's a dear friend of his. He's so upset that all he's managed to do is just bury this person. And now he's exhausted and with sorrow. Let us put a few stones on top of this mound. Let's build a little kind of cairn, as they say in Scotland, to this poor person's beloved friend or father." So they do this, they build a thing, and then they move on. And then after a while, some more travellers. If, by the way, if you don't know what direction this story is going in yet, then you can't have spent any time at all in the guru story. Some more people come along and they say, "Look at this man sitting by the side of the road. Look, some people have built, you know, they've built this kind of little sort of stupa, like a Buddhist stupa to him. There's a mound and there are these stones on top. He must be a wise man. He must be a holy and spiritual man. Let us sit down at his feet, you know, and perhaps he will give us of his wisdom. Perhaps he will start teaching us. And if he doesn't teach us, at least we can absorb his energy." And so they sit there. And all the while, as this has been happening, the guru's son said nothing at all. Whoever comes along, he just sat there. He says nothing. And then some more travellers come along and they say, "Look, there's a holy man sitting here with his devotees, you know, and this mound they've built to celebrate him. You know, he must have wisdom. Let's sit down and join these people. You know, he doesn't seem to be saying anything. He must be one of these gurus who teaches, you know, silent wisdom." And more travellers come along, and more, and they join them until this group is getting larger and larger. And they begin to think, if we built a little ashram here, we wouldn't have to go back to our villages at night. We could just sit here and absorb the holy energy of our guru 24 hours a day. Still, the guru's son has said nothing at all. He's just sitting there, just sitting. And so they build a little ashram. And then more people come along, and after a little while the ashram gets too small, so they decide to put a second story on it, and then they build another wing, and then another wing, and then they suddenly find they have four wings, and they have a courtyard, and they think, let's build a meditation hall. And all the time more and more and more people are coming, and this ashram is growing up, and all the guru's son is doing is just sitting there, and he never says a word. And eventually, this huge, his fame begins to spread, and this huge ashram grows up around him. And he gives satsang, but of course he always gives satsang in silence, because he never speaks. And fame begins to spread and spread and spread, and eventually the fame of this guru spreads so far that it reaches his father's ashram, a long, long way away. And his father says, I must go and see this holy man. He sounds wonderful. It sounds like he's got almost as many followers as me. Maybe he's a competitor. Anyway, I will go and see. So the father sets out with an entourage, because he's a very important guru, a huge entourage, and eventually they reach the ashram, and he can see this tiny little figure of the guru sitting on a sage, sort of in the distance, in this huge, huge meditation hall, and he crowds of people everywhere, and he pushes his way through the crowds, and he gets to the front, and he manages to get really close to the guru, who is sitting silently in the middle of this stage, and he gets right up to him, and then in astonishment he realizes his own son, and he says, son, how has this happened? I don't believe it. You've become this, you were such a wastrel, and you've become this incredibly famous guru. What happened? So the son looks up and says, oh, hello, Dad, how lovely to see you. Well, what happened? He tells his father the whole story from the moment that the donkey died and everything that has happened since. And his father listens to him, and at the end of the guru's account of his story, his father looks at him and he says, son, he says, that is amazing. Do you know, exactly the same thing happened to me. So going back to the question, who knows? Who knows what's happening?
Richard, where's your donkey?
It's buried outside.
It's interesting that in one way, usually people, they have some kind of promise, and that keeps people coming to their gurus or teachers or something, with your hope that there will be some fulfillment. And here in this situation, because it's totally the opposite, you're saying there's nothing to do, you can nothing, what you can do, it happen or it won't happen, and still we're sitting here.
Yes. I'm not saying there's nothing you can do. I'm saying there is no one. There's a huge difference. Huge difference. Doing happens. All sorts of doings may happen. They just happen.
Well, what I'm pointing is that in the other way, it seems that there is something personal can be done.
Yeah.
And yet you said it happened or won't happen. It's nothing what I personally can do. It's still interesting. How we are functioning. I don't know if I make myself clear.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, I could say, as I've said before, yeah, cause and effect have no, causality has no purchasing. But we could say, again, something I've referred to before, that of course, recognizing this is recognizing that almost everything is unknown and unknowable. So cause, I could say cause and effect where this is concerned, well, it's unknowable. If the mind's attracted to a story about cause and effect, it will be attracted to a story. And then it will probably find itself doing stuff. The natural question for the mind may then be, is that stuff, whatever it is, meditation or sitting with a guru or whatever it may be, is that stuff useful? Because the mind can't really help thinking in that way. Is it useful? Will it get me anywhere? Will it bring about a result? Will it bring about a reward? All of that's completely unknowable. Not unknown, but unknowable. And so, when it's recognized that it's unknowable, the mind does tend to let it go.
Yeah, and that's relieving.
Yeah, it may well be, yeah.
At least for me.
Yeah.
For this one.
So what happens if there's an attraction to sitting with a guru and meditating, for example, then that'll probably happen. It doesn't matter. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just what's happening. If that attraction dies away, then it probably won't happen. That's not good, it's not bad. It's just what's happening. In either case, liberation may be seen or may not be seen. But all that stuff that we do or do not do, it all belongs to the person. It all seems to be what the person's deciding. This has nothing to do with anything to do with the person.
Actually, you don't know.
What is it we don't know?
Will it happen or not?
Yeah. 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 Oh, it'll happen. It'll happen. Whether it happens while that psychophysical organism is still running is a different matter. Going back to what you were saying, of course, one of the things that happens in a kind of, going back to this kind of Indian and yogic culture, is that it can be enormously emotionally fulfilling. You know, you can have movements with so much colour and dance and celebration and, I mean, chanting with a large group of people. It's a lovely thing to do. Well, it may be. It's a lovely thing to do if you find If you find it lovely, not everybody does, but a lot of people do. And so one of the things that goes on, and if you think of Anna, for example, who comes to London, I think, a couple of times a year, and has sort of hundreds, maybe thousands of people come. There is that thing that it can be emotionally incredibly rich, you know, really lovely, really beautiful on an emotional level. If you resonate with it, obviously some people don't resonate with it at all and they wouldn't go near it. But if you do resonate with it, it just can be just so beautiful. And it offers other things as well, like companionship, you know, with like-minded people and so on. So it's not surprising, you know, that there are movements like that which are enormously attractive to many, many people. The problem again is that, you know, this isn't about emotionalism. That's the problem.
Richard, do you know Amma?
I haven't been to her personally, but I know many people who do go to see her, yeah.
I wonder these days, Amma, she is, she's like breaking the laws of she's hugging like for 16 hours, so I don't know how to say in English, she seems to break human laws, like laws of not going through the wall.
Right, okay. I would stress the word seems in that sentence. You say she seems to.
She does.
So what are you saying? She has
stitches. She's walking through the wall.
Yeah.
And what she does is amazing. She's around 60 and she's staying awake all night hugging 1,000 people. So it's something.
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at there, because there's kind of two different levels in what you seem to be talking about. Staying awake all night and hugging for 16 hours, walking through walls. That's sort of two different realities, really.
Not so different.
Well, hang on a minute. One, like all miracles, suspends the laws of physics. The other doesn't. Staying awake all night and hugging for 16 hours does not suspend the laws of physics. Walking through walls does suspend the laws of physics. So what is it like for you? Before we have tea and biscuits, this is a very interesting one to then move on to chocolate biscuits from. What is it like for you then? How do you relate to those two possible realities?
Oh, for me it's the same. I cannot even stay one night. Now it's very strange. I just wondered what is she supposed to be enlightened?
Yeah.
I don't know how to.
Alright, let me say two very quick things here, because it is tea time, and if you like we can come back to this afterwards.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to cut it off, I'm just very anxious that we should get to the chocolate biscuits. I'm much more interested in the chocolate biscuits than I am in Sidney's, right? So I would just say two things. One is, I strongly suspect that the laws of physics do not suspend themselves around Anna, or indeed around any other figure. I strongly suspect that. However, I would like to add that whether they do or whether they don't is entirely irrelevant to what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, whether there really are gurus who can perform the siddhi of demanifesting their molecules and remanifesting them to the other side of a wall, whether that is so or not, has nothing whatsoever to do with seeing that there is no one. There is no one who either fails at a siddhi or who succeeds as a siddhi.
Yeah,
so that's what I say.
It's all about around this Amma and this. I mean, there's a strong energy. So when I came first time, it's really like you're ecstatic just to be in this.
There may be a huge, there may be all sorts of things around it, some of which are very readily explainable in terms of, you know, the group itself, what it offers, the colour, and so forth. Some of which may be explainable in more esoteric terms, you know, to do with energy, you know, which we can't really know about. But it's a phenomenon. And if it's a phenomenon to which we're attracted, we'll probably find ourselves there.
So it just happens like this?
Of course. It just happens like this.
Women have so much power to serve all these people and attracting, so it's just a kind of appearance.
It's a play, just as this is a play. It's a play of energy. Just as this is the play of energy. But in terms of what we're talking about here, it's just what's happened. It's just what's happening. People tell a story about, I hadn't heard this by the way, about this city, but people tell a story about Amma walking through walls or not.
Yeah, I don't.
Amma does walk through walls or she doesn't. I strongly suspect she doesn't, but never mind. I am a bit of a skeptic where this is concerned. But in any case, it's a story.
Yeah.
It's what's arising. What we're talking about here is whether that story arises for someone or for no one. Because even if it's seen that there is no one, until there's physical death, the story still arises, the dream still arises. The dream of Amma, the dream of chocolate biscuits. Come back to it after tea if you want to.
Yeah.